You're listening to All the Best Stories from Sydney on FBI.
Welcome to All the Best this Saturday morning. My name is Eliza Salos. Back in this seat for the first time in a while, a big thank you to both Emma Swift and Gina McKeon for bringing you All the Best over the last couple of weeks. It is a pleasure to be back. On today's program, we have a bit of a mixed bag for you. We'll be looking at the history of Sydney's drag venues. We'll discover how local designer Berto Pandolfo honed his craft, and we head to Ashfield to discover a store frozen in time. First up, though, we meet Sally Shipard, 6 years on from becoming the youngest footballer to ever represent Australia at an Olympic Games.
I'm at the AIS, watching the Matildas fit in one last hard training session before they depart to their club duties. I'm here to speak to one of the eldest, most experienced players on the team.
My name is Sally Shipard. I'm now 22 years old. I started playing football when I was 4 or 5.
In 2004, Sally became the youngest footballer ever to represent Australia in the Olympic Games.
The Olympics was unreal. I mean, we made the quarterfinals and I wasn't, I guess, a conditioned member of the side until the Olympics, until I played every minute bar 8, which was, I guess, pretty unexpected considering I was only 16 and just into the national team. But just the parties and, you know, afterwards, and we made it to the quarters, lost to Brazil, and we had about 2 weeks just to go back to the village and watch events. And, you know, as a 16-year-old kid, I've got expectations now when it comes to parties. I'll just leave it at that.
The balance between football and regular life has always been a kind of struggle for Sally, especially when she hit those crucial years of high school.
I actually sat most of my HSE over in America. I went with my doctor, our team doctor, to the airport to sit my maths exam beforehand, yet he forgot the papers that I was to to answer the questions, so, which are pretty vital in a maths exam, I'm not sure if you remember, but in the end, the team came, brought the rest of the gear, and my coach gave me his first class seat home.
In May this year, the Matildas became the first Australian football team to win an Asian Cup. Next year, they're off to Germany to compete in the World Cup. This success, though, hasn't translated to their paychecks in any way. But that doesn't seem to bother Sally.
Does it ever frustrate you that if you were a guy, you'd be swept away and be earning millions?
I always get asked this question, and to be honest, no. I mean, obviously, a bit more money would be nice, but it kind of forces you into other sort of careers. And I mean, I've sort of stuck with uni, and most of the girls, the older girls in our group, have full-time jobs, and it just kind of forces you into that balance. And whether or not you're in one injury away, we've got that one thing to fall back on. So I don't know. There's perks, and I guess there's positives and negatives, but I try and focus on the positives.
This balance hasn't always been clear for Sally.
It got too much when I was about 21, and also I just wasn't enjoying it. So I took myself away from the sport, retired at the grand old age of 21, and took myself overseas for a year and a half, and now I'm back into it. You know, realise that football is what I want to be doing, and as long as I'm sort of pursuing other passions, then I'm happy.
Did you need that time off?
Yes. All I wanted to do when I was a kid was play football. And there's just such, you know, and I got to the point where I felt that there wasn't anything I could do apart from football. And, you know, I just wasn't healthy in a lot of sort of facets of my life. And, yeah, stepping away was a really easy decision to make. And also going overseas on my own was an easy decision to make. The tough, you know, time and the bits that I've had to face are coming back from overseas pretty much over the past year, just sort of dealing with, you know, what I want to do and, you know, just sort of things in my head that I want to sort of straighten out in order to be, you know, the person that I want to be.
After the game, I watch Sally joking around with the new batch of 16-year-olds. And it hits me hard because Sally and I are both 22 and I've barely started my career. And yet here she is, a veteran of the game. She's excelled, burnt out, retired, made a comeback, and is now a mentor for these new teenagers that are in the same position that she was 6 years ago.
I don't know, I really like having them around, and I really like having a joke with them. You know, they kind of remind you that life isn't so serious, and I like the 16-year-old girls coming through, and I will be reminding them to sort of keep an eye on the rest of their life, not just their football.
Sally Shipard, speaking with Nikita Agzarian for All the Best. It's the name of the program you're tuned into here on FBI 94.5. We'll be with you this morning until 11. Still to come in the program, we look at Sydney's drag venues throughout the ages. Meet Berto Pandolfo, one of Australia's shining lights in the field of design. Yes, that pun was intended. All that and more here on All the Best. You're listening to All the Best here on FBI 94.5.
Stories from Sydney. This is All the Best on FBI.
Now, Sydney's first crossdresser is dated back to 1835 when convict Edmund Carman was caught by police in Countryside near Wollongong. It was, however, the 1995 movie Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, that inextricably joined drag and Sydney in the world's eye. But of course, drag queens have been a fixture of the city for years. Poppy Stockell of the Dictionary of Sydney speaks with Judy Burnett to find out more.
I've always wanted to look fabulous. As growing up as a child, I saw all those MGM Hollywood movies, all those musicals, with everybody looking fabulous and dancing, and I always wanted to be there. Under any circumstances, I wanted to be there, whether it be as a male or as a female, it didn't matter. I came to Sydney for a holiday when I was 19, and I enjoyed myself so much I decided to come back. I first started work at a place called Shea Ivy's, and I was the bunny girl behind the bar. And I was there for probably about 2 to 3 years, and then I auditioned for the Purple Onion, and I ended up getting a job at the Purple Onion. I was there for maybe 12 months. It was basically a milk bar with a side passage. So the milk bar area had curtains across the glass windows. That was the dressing room. You walked down a small corridor. It opened into a very big room. They had Hessian hanging off the walls, and they had chairs built in, you know, like cubicles, but not as cubicles, just rows of tables and chairs. And on a Sunday night, it would be so crowded, they would get wooden crates, drink crates from out the back, and they would put them down and people would sit on those. You couldn't move in the place because it was only open Thursday, Friday and Saturday nights. Oh, Sunday nights as well, sorry. But Sunday nights was the night when all the entertainers that had come in from overseas didn't work on Sunday nights. They all came to see the shows. Dusty Springfield was there, Diane Warwick, Robert Helpman, because they weren't working. None of their venues were open, but ours was. The shows started about 10:30 at night, and they went through till approximately 12:30, 1 o'clock, and then you, the half an hour later, 3/4 hour later, all the people had gone. The Purple Onion closed 1975, I think, somewhere around there. And in that space of time, Ivy had sold Shea Ivy's and had opened the Birdcage, which was in Darlinghurst. Probably the first gay venue on Oxford Street, but it was at Bondi Junction. And then she opened the Birdcage, which was on the corner of Flinders Street and Oxford Street. So basically more people probably went there because it was more central. It was easier to get to. Once the Birdcage closed, that's when Capriccio's opened. and Capriccio's was on Oxford Street. Because one would close and another one would open. I worked at Capriccio's, but I did the afternoon shows because in those days I made costumes during the day. Then I'd go home, eat, get dressed, and go to Capriccio's and do shows, and then the next morning get up and go to work again. And sometimes you wouldn't get home until 4 o'clock in the morning, and you'd have to be at work by at least 9 the next day. So you didn't get very much sleep. That's what it was all about. It was all about looking fabulous and having a great time. That's what it was about. And enjoying life, basically, to the fullest.
Poppy Stockell from the Dictionary of Sydney, speaking with Judy Burnett. You can find out more information on Sydney's past by visiting their site, dictionaryofsydney.org. This right now, it's Flying Lotus here on FBI 94.5. Berto Pandolfo was born in Coomer, Australia, and graduated with a Bachelor of Industrial Design in 1998 in Canberra. He then moved to Sydney, where he began working for Sunbeam. In the intervening years, Berto honed the craft of lighting design in Italy, leading into the launch of a self-produced design range that has gone on to receive acclaim both locally and abroad. Berto Pandolfo's design interests focus around the aim to investigate how new and emerging technologies can be introduced and benefit product design and the end user in a non-exclusive manner. Here he is, courtesy of the Audio Design Museum.
I belong to the designer-maker community, I suppose. Yeah, my business is a small one, and therefore, I don't have a factory or anything like that. I organise things to be made. I actually applied to do architecture, but wasn't accepted, and fortuitously fell into industrial design, which I think suits my character much better. I found a job at Sunbeam. It taught me something really important, many things I suppose, one of which was that there is a beauty in every object, no matter how banal or invisible it may be, like a little spring or a bracket inside a toaster. In designing that bracket, you know, you need to be efficient with materials, it needs to be manufacturable. I learned that there is a beauty in those sort of small components. So I went to Italy in 1991, I think it was. I was accepted to the Domus Academy, I did my master's, and then landed a job with Floss Lighting. Floss is a recognised lighting brand. I worked with many of internationally recognised designers like Stark and Morrison and Giovannoni in taking their products from often what would be a sketch into production. And that taught me, where Sunbeam taught me how to be very precise and finicky about every last detail. Floss taught me about the value of, the emotion, the value of capturing someone's attention through magical design or magical effect of lighting, which, you know, is synonymous with Italian design. While I was in Italy, I was also proposing my own designs. So I, developed the photo frame for Alessi, the doorstop for Design Outlook Italia, where we had our first child, our first son, Matteo, and Juliet fell pregnant with Tommaso, our second son. We decided to return to Australia. One thing I was able to do was start to develop my own products. That came to fruition in 2002 with the coat stand, the rack coat stand, and that started a collection of three products in CNC cut plywood. There's the coat stand, the magazine rack, and a dining table. And so that was me trying to work as a designer in Australia, so trying to find suppliers, find materials, trying to be clever. And it was exciting, and of those three products, the coat stand is by far the most successful, and it still sells quite well. And I've since become quite busy here at UTS. I've had to take over the role of course director, so that's taken me away from my research. My research is my design practice. I can experiment with materials, with processes, with typologies. And so it's really been a wonderful discovery to find that academia is really suited to, you know, what I really want to do. Because I'm fascinated by manufacture, by factories. You know, I have a belief that's supported by a lot of literature and a lot of experts that a healthy community, a healthy society needs to have manufacturing as a part of it. You just can't have society based around a knowledge system or an information system. It needs to have a manufacturing system, because a manufacturing environment, firstly, you're making something, so you're transforming something into a product that sells, but also a factory has a wide variety of personnel. So you've got janitors and cleaners and factory workers, but then you've got engineers and salespeople and executives, and so it's a diverse system of people. Our manufacturing sector is ever reducing, whereas in Europe and in Italy it's not. It's core to the activity, core to the economy. So it's difficult for designers here to get a variety of options in terms of making things, so that's challenging. Over a period of time, I had noticed lots of little vans and trucks with air conditioning ducting on the back of their truck. And I thought, wow, that's obvious. I was thinking, there must be a lot of workshops that work in sheet metal. I could see it everywhere. And I thought, oh, yeah, well, that's connected to the building industry. And so I thought, I need to get involved in sheet metal. There's obviously a lot of people that do it. It means it wouldn't be hideously expensive. I just need to get involved and create something. So from that, I wanted to develop something in sheet metal, and started by doing a chair. And I've got a box here of a couple of hundred models made out of sheet metal that evolved into the stool, the Crumb stool. And so that is now another one of my products. It gets prepared by a company out in Wetherill Park. It's really relatively easy to assemble, so I assemble it and it goes out.
Berto Pandolfo, self-described as a designer-maker. That piece was created for the Audio Design Museum. Find out more at audiodesignmuseum.com. You're listening to FBI 94.5. Still to come, we will be heading to Ashfield to discover a store frozen in time. Right now, however, this is Jens Lechmann. You're the light by which I travel through.
Yeah, I got busted, so I used my one phone call to dedicate a song to you on the radio.
Right now, though, you are listening to All the Best Stories from Sydney on FBI. This next one comes to us from Ashfield with Vanessa Berry.
Usually when I look through the window, there is no one inside. The shop is a graveyard of glass cabinets, inside which rest old cameras and dusty boxes of film. The clutter is appealing. It seems to hold secrets. The biggest secret is how Cole's photo has remained unchanged on Liverpool Road in Ashfield, which is now a street of bargain shops and restaurants with dripping glazed ducks in the window displays. Cole's is old, anachronistic, a gift to the imagination. I have often passed by and dreamed up different stories explaining how it has come to remain there. Through it, I can travel back in time. If I focus on the shop, I can imagine the street behind me winding back 30 years or even more. People's faces and clothes change. The cars on the street become the boxy, bright wagons that prowled 1970s streets. This time, to my shock, there's someone in there. A tall, old man with neat black hair, wearing big, yellow-tinted glasses. I tap on the door and he comes to open it, and then I am standing inside. It is peaceful, dimly lit, with the particular comfort of a place that has been unchanged for many years. After I buy a roll of film, which I later notice has passed its expiry date, we quickly fall into a conversation. To explain my purchase, I tell him I'm old-fashioned and still use a film camera sometimes. This information is like a password. He tells me that since he was 10 years old, he wanted to be a photographer. My first camera was made out of wood, he says, stretching his hands out to indicate the size and shape of this invisible antique. This action opens the door to his memories. I have two loves, though. The other is music. He tells me how he played the trumpet and the accordion and used to work as a professional musician before he gave it up for his wife. Her Jewish parents forbade her from marrying him, as he was Russian Orthodox. She gave up her family, and he gave up the orchestras and the wild life that came with playing in them, and they married. He gestures next door to the shop beside his. It is the haberdashery equivalent of the photo shop, with old bright tea towels and sewing equipment neatly arranged in the window. This shop is a ghost. He tells me, to the day, how long his wife has been gone. We were married for 59 years. I see there are tears in his eyes, and although I am not the kind of person who usually does such things, I put my hand on his. It is then I notice he has big hands that look slightly out of proportion to his body. I imagine them stretched around an accordion. I leave my hand on his for a moment, saying nothing, as he tells me how he can't sleep, and that it's at night he misses her more than anything. He continues their story. Up until now, I have not been able to place his features or his accent. Both are unusual, and he has a particular grace and gentility that I imagine must be from somewhere very removed in time and place from here. He tells me he is 90 years old and from Harbin, in Manchuria, in China. All I know of this place is that every year it has an ice festival with huge ice sculptures. Last year, I had seen on the news, there was a giant ice Santa Claus. All I know about Harbin is that it gets very cold, I say. And he tells me with a look of joy that it gets very, very cold and very, very hot. But not the Sydney kind of heat. I played with the Czechoslovakian orchestra on the river on a day that was 47 degrees, but we did not sweat, he says, gesturing to his armpit. I picture this day as an old photograph, sepia with worn edges, with the players dapper and stoic inside their suits. My wife does not like the heat, but I do. I like to float in the salt water. We speak for almost an hour, although I say very little apart from the odd question. His life tumbles out, grief and love and risk and change. These are stories he must have told countless times, and they come out in a mixture, skipping decades, skipping continents. He tells them with great zest, as if by telling them he is able to bring the times and people back. He leans against the shelf with the packets of film on it, then forward again to rest his hands on the counter, and I think how many times he must have done these particular movements while telling these stories. The Russian army took his watch. He has two accordions but no longer plays them since he lost his wife. He went to Shanghai with the orchestra and played in the Park Hotel, 11 stories high. Russia is in a mess, but look at China. Everything you buy is from China. He gestures outside, and I remember we are actually in Ashfield. I don't remember how to speak Chinese. Since I came here, all English. Did you grow up speaking Russian, I asked. Russian I never forget, he says, looking proud. It is at this moment that a bewildered-looking teenage couple enter the shop, and I decide it's time for me to go. He smiles widely as his hand grips mine in a firm shake, and I notice the faint smell of cigarette smoke in the room. I like to imagine him in a room out the back of the shop, smoking, developing photographs, thinking in Russian. He looks at me intently. I recognise you, he says. I've seen you before. Make some good photos.
Vanessa Berry with a story originally published with Ordinary. Find it and more like it at ordinarymagazine.org. You are on FBI 94.5 right now. Something from the Straight Arrows. That's all for today's program. Kate Jinks is up next with Too Much. Thanks to all our guests and to today's producers, Nikita Agzarian and Vanessa Berry. Big thanks to our EP, Bridget Dagg, and to you for listening. Next week...
The day that Jim Beetson rang me and said, we're going to start a radio station, I think we probably couldn't have done what we intended to do if we'd got the license when we first asked for it.
That's Cass Wilkinson, the president of FBI. And on next week's program, it's the story of FBI. We'll be looking at how this station came to be and speak with the people that made an inkling of an idea, a phenomenal reality. an episode of All the Best not to be missed. Hopefully. See you then here on FBI 94.5.
All the best
stories from Sydney
on FBI 94.5.